get started. We're running a little bit late, and I'm sorry about that. My name's Lisa Maher, and I work at the National Centre in HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research in Sydney, in Australia. I'd like to welcome you all to MOAC2, which is the session Global Responses to HIV Prevention Among Injecting Drug Users. I just wanted to make a comment before we start that we've been hearing a lot in Australia lately, and we heard a little bit yesterday about criminalization in the context of HIV transmission and prevention. I think when you hear people at this conference talk about criminalization and stigma and discrimination, it's important to remember that most IDUs around the world confront this on a daily basis. Despite the illegality that often defines their vulnerability to HIV and other blood-borne viruses, there's overwhelming evidence that injecting drug users worldwide have shown an extraordinary sense of responsibility in responding to the epidemic. And as David Cooper pointed out in the plenary last night, there's no substantive epidemic of HIV among injecting drug users in Australia. I think we need to acknowledge and give credit that this achievement rests with injecting drug users and drug user organisations. Our first speaker today is Dr. Supat Vanatseni. She is working in the group of BTSG, the Bangkok Tenofovir Study Group, after completing the clinical trial of the AIDS vaccine in Thailand. She's a leading researcher. She's been around and working in this field for almost 20 years and working a lot with injecting drug users in Thailand. Welcome.
Thank you, Lisa. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First, I'd like to thank the conference organizer for giving me the opportunities to discuss HIV-associated risk behaviors among participants in the Bangkok Tenofovir study, an HIV prevention trial being conducted in Bangkok, Thailand. So, the trial is a collaborative effort managed by the Bangkok Tenofovir Study Group. Other BTSG team includes the Bangkok Metropolitan Administration, the Thailand Ministry of Public Health, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It is important to point out that this trial would not be possible without the support of intravenous drug users in Bangkok. We are grateful to those who come to screen and enroll, and the members of Community Relations Committee who help guide the study. This is a map of Bangkok. The BTS is conducted in the 17 Bangkok Metropolitan Administration drug treatment clinics, represented by red stars. Bangkok Metropolitan Administration, or BMA, the BMA clinic provided HIV prevention package of HIV risk reduction education and counseling on sex and injection behaviors with demonstration how to bleach or cleaning the needles and syringe and how to put on condom effectively and distribute free of charge. And treatment for sexually transmission infections and other health services with voluntary HIV testing, pre- and post-test counseling, and methadone maintenance program, all free of charge. Okay. Participant demographic characteristics and risk behavior were assessed at enrollment and risk behaviors every 3 months during follow-up. In order to evaluate risk behaviors, we compared the proportion of participants who reported injecting drugs and sharing needle syringe at enrollment and month 3, 6, 9, 12, and 18. We also used generalized estimation logistic regression analysis to identify predictors of injection and sharing. Risk behavior data are collected using audio computer assisted self-interview, or ACASI. ACASI has been shown to increase validity and reliability of response to sensitive questions. Injection behavior assessed with the following questions. Have you injected any drug in the past 3 months, yes or no? And the past 3 months, did you ever inject with needle or syringe that someone else had used, yes or no? Demographic data were available on 1,641 participants. 78% were male. The median age was 31 years. 48% had a primary education or less. 43% had completed secondary school, and 9% had post-secondary school. During the 3 months before enrollment or baseline, 25% were in methadone program. 62% inject with a relatively even distribution of methamphetamine, heroin, and midazolam. 8% inject daily injection, and 22% weekly, 32% less than weekly, and 17% shared needles. 80% reported one or less than one sexual partners, and majority did not have sex with casual partners. Report of injecting and needle sharing have fallen significantly during follow-up. Injecting declined since month 3 from 62% at baseline to 32%. Needle sharing from 17% to 3% since month 3. We include baseline demographic characteristics in multivariate analysis to investigate risk factors for injection or needle sharing. Male sex, age, more than 26 years, and more than primary school education were independent predictors of injecting. Male may be more likely to share needles, though this finding did not reach statistical significance. In summary, the BMA drug treatment clinics provide IDUs a package of HIV prevention and risk reduction tools. The research team is monitoring participation risk behavior. The proportion of participants reporting injecting and sharing has declined significantly from baseline since month 3 through month 18. Finally, I'd like to thank all those who helped us launch this important trial, especially the volunteers for their courage and willingness to participate. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Zupac. And our next speaker is Dr. Carolyn Day, who's from the National Center for HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research. And she's now a postdoctoral fellow, and she's a senior lecturer at the University of Sydney. Her background is in public health, and Carolyn's going to talk to us today about a decade of HIV surveillance among injecting drug users in Australia, the results from the Australian Needle and Syringe Program survey. So thank you very much, Carolyn.
Thank you. Today I'm going to be talking about the results from the last 10 years of the Australian Needle and Syringe Program survey. And firstly, I'd like to make a dedication to the late Dr. Margaret MacDonald, because so much of the work that I'm presenting today is due to her dedication and hard work. So first of all, a little bit of background about HIV in Australia. The first HIV or AIDS case, as it would have been, was reported in 1982. And by 1985, there were reports of cases among injecting drug users. Nevertheless, it appears that the epidemic in Australia has really followed one where it's been largely among gay men or men who have sex with men. The prevalence of HIV among injecting drug use has been, from the early days, somewhat variable. The first data from 1987 found a 12% prevalence rate of HIV among injectors, and by 1994 there was a 7% prevalence rate. But when cases of people reporting homosexual or bisexual contact were excluded, that prevalence rate was only 2%. And with that very first study, the one in 1987 showing 12%, there were some sampling issues which may have inflated that figure. For example, some of the people were recruited through AIDS clinics, etc. So what we know about HIV in Australia is that among injecting drug users is that there's been overall a fairly low prevalence, but there have been some things that have occurred over the last 10 or so years which may or may not have impacted on this. So we know that there's been some significant changes in the drug market. We know that there's been a big decrease in the use of heroin and some fairly significant increases in the use of methamphetamine, and these may or may not have had an impact. And we also know that there's been some recent increases in HIV diagnoses in Australia. So this is part of the reason why we thought that it was a good idea to look over the last 10 years at this surveillance data. Some background around needle and syringe programs in Australia. The first program commenced in 1986, so almost 21 years ago, by our chair, Dr. Wodak. And since that time, they've become reasonably widespread and are largely publicly funded. Obviously, there are pockets where the availability of needles and syringes is not particularly good, but for the most part, we can say that they're reasonably widespread. Needle and syringe programs have bipartisan support in Australia, and there's some evidence that there's a lot of general public support as well for the programs. The programs are delivered through a range of different models, including fixed site, so just sort of shop front site needle and syringe programs where people can go in and get their syringes and leave. There's outreach, there are vending machines, and they're also delivered through some pharmacy programs. And it's a program of distribution rather than one of exchange, so people don't need to be returning their used syringes. There are obviously your bins, etc., and that's encouraged, but people can just simply come in and request new equipment. They don't need to be returning equipment. So the aims of the National Needle and Syringe Program, which was set up in 1995, was to monitor HIV prevalence and risk behaviour among injecting drug users in Australia. It also aims to look at hepatitis C as well, but I'm presenting data today on HIV. So in terms of this talk, what I'd like to do is look at trends in HIV prevalence and risk behaviours for the period 1995 to 2004, and also look at some of the correlates of HIV infection. So the methods, it's a cross-sectional survey, and it involves a brief survey that collects information on demographics, drug use and treatment history, injecting and sexual risk, and previous bloodborne virus testing. It's a self-completed questionnaire, but assistance is available where required. So if people have difficulty with literacy or vision or whatever, there's assistance required, assistance available. A capillary blood sample is collected, and that's tested using standard HIV testing. The survey is conducted during 1 week in October. Sometimes that may blow out a little bit into the following week, but usually it's the first, usually it's 1 week in October. The eligibility is basically anyone attending the needle and syringe program during the study week is eligible to participate in the survey. For the purposes of today, we have deduplicated the data. There are obviously over the 10 years a number of people who have participated more than once. So in order to do that, there's a unique identifier, which is the first two initials and both the first name and surname. So using that along with the year of birth and sex and Indigenous status, we've excluded multiple entries. And in terms of what I've done is some trend analyses and then finally some aggregated the data to look at correlates. So in terms of participation, you can see that the survey started out including 21 sites in 1995 and recruited over 1,000 people. And in 2004, it had 43 sites and recruited just over 2,000 people. The mean response rate has been reasonably low, I guess, at 47%, but it's ranged from 41% in 1995 through to 60% in 1997. I should add at this point, which hasn't been included on the slides, that there's no incentive to participate in this survey. People are simply asked to take part and they don't receive anything for taking part. The median age has been 29 years. About two-thirds are male and 34% female, with under less than 0.5% transgender. 78% of participants report their sexual preference as heterosexual, which means that 16% are reporting either homosexual or bisexual sexual preference. The participants were injecting for a median of 9 years, and the last drug injected was mainly heroin at 45% and 28% methamphetamine, and then the other drugs are really much more methadone, cocaine, etc., much lower proportions and normally around sort of 5%, certainly less than 10% of the sample. 50% of the sample report daily or more injecting, and 8% report having been paid for sex in the last month. So just looking here at some of the trends in sample characteristics, if you just have a look, I guess the easiest one to look is this legend key here, and I've just put whether or not there's been a decreasing or increasing trend. So, for example, with males, you can see here there's been no trend. That's been fairly consistent over time. There's been a slight increase in the median age, and that's consistent with other Australian data on injecting drug users. It appears that we have an ageing cohort. The daily injecting has remained fairly steady. It's sort of gone up and down a bit, but it's over time remained reasonably steady. Heroin use has significantly decreased, and once again that's consistent with what we know about the Australian drug market. Similarly with methamphetamine, which has significantly increased. And sex work, there's been a very slight increase in sex work over the past 10 years of people reporting sex work. In terms of actual HIV prevalence, it doesn't really look like much here, but there has in fact been a significant decrease in HIV over the last 10 years. There's also been, consistent with that, a decrease in the number of people reporting homosexual or bisexual preference. And there's been an overall decrease in people reporting having shared a needle or syringe in the last month. Similarly, a decrease in condoms used in the last sexual episode, and an increase in the number of people reporting having had casual sex in the last month. Looking at correlates of HIV infection, all of those factors that I've gone through were put into the model. They were all significant on univariate analysis, and they were put into the multivariate model. And you can see here that the risk of HIV increases slightly with age, bearing in mind this is cross-sectional data. So these are really just relationships, they're not necessarily predictors. As we would expect, there's an association with male gender and a very strong association with reporting homosexual, bisexual, sexual preference. There's an association with methamphetamine. HIV-positive people are more likely to report methamphetamine as the last drug they've injected, but they're less likely to be reporting daily injecting. And they're also less likely to report condom use than the last sexual episode, or rather more likely. So in terms of the limitations of the study, as I mentioned, it's a series of cross-sectional surveys. And one of the key, I guess, limitations is that needle and syringe programs are a point of prevention. So it may not necessarily seem like the best place to be targeting this group, but as many of you here will know that accessing injecting drug users, given the hidden nature of the behaviour and the illegality of it, can be very difficult. And because needle and syringe programs are so widespread in Australia, it provides a useful sentinel point of surveillance. And certainly that the data are consistent with other studies that don't necessarily go to needle and syringe programs to recruit participants. The low response rate is obviously somewhat of a problem, being less than 50% overall, but recent work that we've done, which I won't go into today, has shown that the respondents are not atypical. I won't say they're entirely representative of the needle and syringe program using group, but they're certainly not atypical of the service users. And obviously with any of this sort of research, particularly around risk behaviour, there are issues with social desirability, and particularly perhaps over time. But we've shown, once again, with this survey recently, that because it's self-report, people are more likely to report honestly, or report honestly being a self-report instrument. So in conclusion, we've noted a decreased HIV prevalence, which has remained at 2%, or less than 2% over the last 10 years. The epidemiology of HIV among this group, therefore, appears to be very much like what we know about the broader Australian population. There have been some variation in risk factors across the years, particularly in terms of patterns of drug use, and decreasing risk behaviours are consistent with other indicators. And finally, needle and syringe programs are a crucial component of Australia's successful HIV surveillance mechanism. And this is a very simple and very cost-effective way of doing HIV surveillance among this group, which otherwise would be a very difficult task. Thank you very much, and I'd just like to acknowledge the various people who have been involved in this data collection, particularly the participants who receive nothing for taking part in this and do it off their own bat, and also particularly for the people working in the needle and syringe programs who put a lot of effort into that 1 week of the year where the survey is conducted. Thank you very much.
I'd like to introduce our next speaker, who's Dr. Sayed Abbas Motavalian. He's from Iran. He's a medical doctor and an epidemiologist. He's also Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the School of Public Health at Iran University of Medical Sciences in Tehran.
Distinguished colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I take this opportunity to thank the International Scholarship Program for supporting me to come here and present the findings of our research, which is about HIV prevalence and risky behaviors among inmates of a prison in Tehran, the capital city of Iran. Also, I would like to thank my colleagues in this research and World Health Organization, Eastern Mediterranean Office, for supporting this study. Let's have a look to some facts about HIV/AIDS in Iran. Iran, with a population of over 70 million, have more than 50,000 of notified HIV cases, which are, it is estimated that 80% of HIV cases have not been notified. So the estimated number of all HIV cases is about 70,000. More than 2,000 AIDS cases have been died since the beginning of the epidemic. The first wave of epidemic began in 1980s by transfusion of infected blood products. Then in mid-90s, the second wave of epidemic emerged among injected drug users. At present, two-thirds of all notified cases are transmitted through sharing needle and syringes, and 7% of cases are due to sexual contact. In this slide, we can see that the distribution of notified HIV cases is not homogeneous in the country. Also, the mode of transmission is different in different regions. For example, in Western high-prevalence provinces, the majority of cases are IDUs, while in South provinces, there are a considerable number of heterosexual transmission because of men traveling to nearby countries and having sex with HIV-infected sex workers. Drug abuse, especially opium addiction and misuse, is a huge public health issue in Iran. It is estimated that at least 2 million drug users, 1.2 million addicts, and 200,000 of injecting drug users are living in the country. 70% of injecting drug users had a history of shared injection. In the prison, at each time, there are 130,000 prisoners. Almost half of them are because of drug-related crimes. And if we consider the incarceration and release of the whole number of prisoners, will be the total number of 600,000 annually. The objective of this study was to determine the prevalence of HIV and risky behaviors in one of the prisons in Tehran, which have one of the highest number of drug-related crime prisoners. This is a cross-sectional study, and the study subjects were prisoners who had an evidence of drug injection and signed the informed consent after a counseling session. The study subjects were two groups, newly entered prisoners and inmates of the prison residing more than 1 week. We call the first group as new entrant and the second one as the old prisoners. We had a questionnaire for demographic and behavioral questions, and we did a test-to-test reliability study for the validation of this questionnaire. And also we had taken blood samples for both ELISA and Western blood lab exams. The study setting was Ghazal-Hisar prison in Tehran province, and the time period was September 2003. It's interesting to know that in the study period, 1,532 new prisoners entered, and 26 of whom were injecting drug users. And from this group, 91% signed the informed consent to enter the study. The most important finding of our study was that the HIV prevalence in new entrants was 22%, and in old prisoners was it was 24%. On average, the age of these are the shown the age at first injection in the first group was 25 years, and the second group 28 years. 72% of the new entrants had injection in the past month, and 20% of their injection in their last injection was shared injection device. And in old prisoners, 29% of the subjects had an injection in past month, and 43% of them had shared injection in their last drug injection. When we ask the subjects about their usual habit for drug injection, 64% of the first group said that they inject more than once a day, while 50% of the second group less than once a day. And almost 35% of the new entrants had a history of sharing injection, and 49% in the second group had a history of sharing injections. 81% of the first group had a history of imprisonment before this this time, and 28% of the new entrants ever injected inside the prison, while 54% of the second group had ever injected inside the prison. 6% of the new entrants and 21% of all prisoners started their injection inside the prison. We had problems with handmade injection devices, and 23% of new entrants and 45% of all prisoners told us that they had used handmade injection devices. About the sexual behavior of the subjects, about 50% of both groups were single, and one third of them had sexual contact with their wives in the last year, and 16% of the new entrants and 9% of the old prisoners had sex with a commercial sex worker in the last year. It is important, the important figure here is that more than 60% of all of the sexual contacts of both groups had never used condoms. When we conducted multiple logistic regression analysis to show what the factors associated with HIV infection in newly entered group, the factors were younger age at first drug injection, lower education level, longer duration of drug injection, frequent sharing of injection device, and longer duration of imprisonment. It's an important finding that HIV prevalence among the new entrants who had no history of imprisonment was about 6%, which is much lower than all of the other groups, which are more than, most of them are higher than 20%. This shows this can be concluded as the prevalence of HIV among IDUs in the community who have not been imprisoned. Factors associated with HIV infection in old prisoners were longer duration of drug injection, frequent sharing of injection device, injection inside the prison, and having a tattoo. The results of this study, as well as other complementary studies, have been used as a strong advocacy tool and was translated to some strong actions in the country. In 2005, half of all 600,000 inmates benefited educational programs within prisons about HIV/AIDS, different types of education. Methadone maintenance treatment started in the country in 2005 with 4,500 people, and in 2006 it expanded to more than 10,000, which covers about 20% of IDUs in the prisons. And this year it has been expanded even more than these figures. A document entitled Needle and Syringe Distribution Guideline for the Prisons have been prepared, and it is to be approved and implemented by the judiciary system in near future. And prison clinics provide condoms upon demand, but no program for condom distribution in corner visit is existed. Future actions needed: decriminalization of drug abuse and reducing the flow of drug users into the prison, expansion of MMT centers, condom distribution for carnal visit, which are 45,000 carnal visits each year in prisons of Iran, and specifically and most important of all of these, special programs for commercial sex workers and partners of injecting drug users are needed to prevent the third wave of HIV epidemic among these women, their other partners, and their children. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, sir. That certainly gives us all a bit of hope listening to the wonderful things that are happening there in your country. Our next speaker is Dr. Sergey Dvoryak, if I've pronounced that correctly. Dr. Dvoryak is a psychiatrist. He's been working with drug users for more than 30 years in the Ukraine, where he comes from. The last 6 years, he's been working in public health, and the main focus of his activity is providing opiate substitution treatment with buprenorphine for drug users, and the particular objective is to control HIV infection spread among injecting drug users in Ukraine. Dr. Dvoryak, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dr. Wodak. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to present data about substitution treatment in Ukraine, which started relatively recently and has some problems and obstacles, but at the same time we had some good success. And the group of researchers and people who work in this program you can see on the screen. It's not enough time to mention everybody of them, but I would like to say that this is a product of big team work. Shortly about drug statistics in Ukraine. During the last 15 years, we experienced some great increasing of drug users, and you can see that estimated data last period in 2006 is about more than 500,000. Before we had no estimated data, but register drug users much less number than in 15 years. This is trends during 1994 and plateau after 2004. HIV transmission in Ukraine, this is mostly through injections and amongst drug users, and only after 2005 the situation a little bit changed, and relatively more percentage people get HIV through sex. But unfortunately, most of them, this is people who had sex with IDUs or with their partners. In fact, still now, drug injections, this is engine of the epidemic in Ukraine. On this slide, you can see a relationship between injection drug using and HIV in different regions, in different cities, and almost everywhere, the more people use drugs, the more people has HIV. Unfortunately, political context regarding to treatment of opioid addiction and particularly substitution treatment is very unclear and ambivalent. We have positive factors and negative. Positive, this is national program of HIV-AIDS prevention, when mentioned that substitution treatment should be main method of prevention HIV infections among drug users, and other documents which mostly prepared by medical professionals. From other side, negative factors, this is activity of Ministry of Interior, service of so-called enforcement ministries, people who has big power to stop dissemination of substitution treatment. Unfortunately, a lot of deputies and other politicians against substitution treatment still now too. It's a situation very similar like in Russia, but I think a little bit better because our constitution and our legislation not so strictly against substitution treatment. According to data of joint mission of WHO, UNAIDS and UNODC, which provided special assessment in Ukraine in 2004, about 30-40% of IDUs dependent from opioids should have access to substitution treatment. In Ukraine now we have 300,000-400,000 who need substitution problem with injection drugs, and accordingly we need 60 to 200,000 courses of substitution treatment. Our first project which provided substitution treatment with buprenorphine was organized with supporting of UNDP in Kyiv and Kherson in 2004 and 2005. It was a relatively small project, not more than 87-90 clients took part in this. According to WHO multi-site prospective study, we use this data and collecting data from our first project and analyzed it in frames of this multi-site prospective study. You can see participants of this study, and it was organized in seven countries: Indonesia, China, Thailand, Iran, Lithuania, Poland, and Ukraine. This was prospective observational study with assessment at baseline and 3 and 6 months follow-ups. The main aims of outcome evaluation were to explore changes in the following domains: health status and well-being of individuals in substitution treatment, community social benefits, and program performance. General protocol of the study was prepared by Dr. Vladimir Pozniak, Professor Ambros Uchtengagen, and Professor Robert Alai from Adelaide University. And data collection sites was Kyiv City Narcology Hospital and Kherson Regional Narcology Hospital. Demographics at treatment entry, 76 participants, most male, and age mean was about 30 years, and most of them use poppy straw. It's so-called homemade heroin, which is very popular in Ukraine and Poland. Drug use during lifetime, it was other opioids, I mean poppy straw, 10.3, and other substances like alcohol, 13 years, and cannabis, 6 years. Changes in well-being, and I just show some data from Poland and Lithuania for comparing, because it's very interesting. We got in different settings, but in fact we received very similar data. Drug use last 30 days, we had at baseline almost 12 in 3 months, 0.02, and in 6 months, almost zero. Drug use last 3 days, dramatically decreasing, especially in first 3 months. Other opioid, this is poppy straw, comparatively in 3 countries. This is in Lithuania, this is Ukraine, and this is Poland. You can see absolutely the same trends. Amphetamine use decreasing also. Health status at baseline, number of physical symptoms 18.8, in 3 months almost in 3 times less, in 6 months less again. And Zoom depression a little bit decreasing also, depressive symptoms. This is graphs of physical symptoms and depression. Quality of life, according to WHO questionnaire. At baseline and 3 months, in 6 months, situation became better, not so dramatically in social domain. Quality of life in three countries, you can see very similar trends. Quality of life, psychological domain. Quality of life, social domain. It's without serious changes in Lithuania. And more important for us, bloodborne virus risk behavior. Injection practices in Ukraine, we got from 13, almost in 12 times less injection activity in 3 months and in 6 months. Very similar data from bloodborne virus risk behavior. This is graphs, and this is in three countries. Criminal employment activity decreased also during 3 and 6 months. Community social benefits, this is self-reported criminal activity, decreased dramatically. Program performance in 6 months, 66% of retention. In Ukraine, we got order of Ministry of Health in April of 2005 for roll out the substitution program from small to sites to more broadly. And finally, we got a project supported the International HIV/AIDS Alliance in Ukraine with money of global funds. And pilot sites were in Kyiv, two sites, Donetsk, Dnipropetrovsk, Odessa, Simferopol, Mykolaiv, Vinnytsia, Poltava, Kherson. Project started buprenorphine substitution treatment in October 2005. And you can see development of substitution treatment during the last 3-4 years. From 2004, when we had 30 persons in treatment, until 2007, when we have 520. But never mind, it's much less than we need according to recommendation of WHO. It's not more than 1.5% of our real needs. This is retention. Most of people continue to use substitution program, and only left the most part of people who left program, it's according to own wish. Number of clients in last project, 522, most of them male, and big number of HIV positive, 63%, people with hepatitis, 63%, and number of dropout about 30%, and retention during 6 years, 6 months, 70%. We providing monitoring and evaluation of these pilot phases, and 200 clients in six sites were under observation. Instruments which we used for this purpose, for monitoring, eligibility checklist, patient recruitment table, and staffing table. For evaluation, addiction severity index, fifth edition, and BBV track. 2, 1 minute. Demographic, very similar, like in previous research. Drug use lifetime, other opiates, it means Papistro 13.5. At baseline, according to addiction severity index, 19 day during 30 days and 1 day in 6 months. this is drug use trends, addiction severity index, dramatically decreasing of drug use, and blood-borne virus risk behavior from 12 to 0.7. The prices of buprenorphine in this country are relatively high, and one course of 60 milligram tablets, $340. And total expenditure on substitution maintenance therapy, about $400 per person per month. Conclusions. Buprenorphine is effective for substitution maintenance therapy in terms of retention in treatment, reduction of opioid use, health status and quality of life improvement, reduction of risky behavior, decrease of criminal involvement. In phase of stabilization, effective dose of buprenorphine is from 8 to 10 milligrams per day. Ukrainian data are similar to Poland, Lithuanian, and other participants of project, which analyzed effectiveness of substitution treatment. Political context is still ambivalent and not supportive in our country. Public health decision makers still are not active in terms of development of substitution treatment in Ukraine and influencing HIV epidemic. And the country needs a new strategy and practice regarding substitution maintenance therapy to promptly respond on the epidemic challenges. Firstly, to broad access to substitution treatment, providing methadone. Thank you for your attention.
And our last speaker today is Dr. Thomas Kerr. Thomas is a research scientist with the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS. He's also an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. He's going to talk to us about responding to the HIV epidemic among injection drug users in Vancouver, evidence of best practice in needle exchange to prevent HIV risk behavior.
Thank you, Lisa. It's an honor to be speaking to you today. Really, what I'm going to present to you today, I think, is probably best described as more of a story than a study. But the good news is that it's a story that didn't start out well and has certainly improved in recent years. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, including our partners at Vancouver Coastal Health. It's, I'm sure, well known in this audience that needle exchanges now have been very well studied and associated with reductions in syringe sharing and incidence of HIV infection, hepatitis and hepatitis B and C, as well as increased rates of entry into detoxification and addiction treatment programs. And as well, there's now an extensive body of research showing that NEPs have had no real discernible negative societal effects, such as increases in drug use, crime, or discarded needles. This body of evidence has now been very well summarized quite recently in two reports, one led by Alex, prepared for the WHO, and another put out by the U.S. Institutes of Medicine. And if you haven't seen them, I strongly encourage you to have a look for them. Despite this large body of evidence, it's important to point out that the U.S. has maintained a ban on federal funding for needle exchanges now for two decades. And many observers believe that this contributes greatly to the fact that real comprehensive needle exchange programs exist in fewer than half of the countries reporting HIV infection among injecting drug users. And despite, again, this growing body of evidence, we too often see media reports like this. This is one from a recent one from our setting, and these continue despite the fact that most major international medical and public health organizations have issued consensus statements supporting the implementation of needle exchange as an essential HIV prevention service for injecting drug users. Unfortunately, some our setting, Vancouver, and some of the early work undertaken there has been the subject of considerable controversy. In particular, we in Vancouver documented a very explosive HIV epidemic among injecting drug users in the presence of a very large needle exchange program. In 1996-97, the annual incidence of HIV infection was approximately 18%. And this controversy also was partly due to related to this one study which showed an association between frequent needle exchange use and HIV prevalence. And this controversy continues to this day. It's largely perpetuated by people who fail to understand what this study really said, and is also perpetuated by those ideologically opposed to harm reduction. It's also sad to note that this study was actually followed up by a very nice paper by Dr. Schechter, Sharathi, and colleagues, which showed that it was a variety of risk characteristics of injecting drug users other than their needle exchange use that really explained this association. As well, we sort of sought to find out, well, what's really driving high-risk syringe sharing in this community? And data from the Vancouver injection drug users showed that individuals who reported difficulty accessing clean syringes were about 3.4 times more likely to share syringes, and those who used needle exchanges as an exclusive source of syringe were about half as likely to report syringe sharing. There's also been some work looking at why people were having difficulty accessing syringes, and in this analysis led by Evan Wood, you can see that the main reason people reported difficulty accessing syringes was the fact that the needle exchange was closed. Ironically, the only fixed needle exchange in the downtown east side, which is home to an estimated 7,000 injecting drug users, closed at 8 p.m. each night. There was this odd belief that this would somehow denocturnalize the neighborhood and people would stop using drugs at 8 o'clock if the needle exchange was closed. The data also here shows that people were having difficulties catching the couple of needle exchange vans that flew around the neighborhood handing out syringes, and other people simply didn't have needles to exchange and therefore didn't go to the fixed site. As is often the case, it was drug users themselves who were many steps ahead of the bureaucracy. Recognizing the problems with difficulty accessing needles, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users established this needle exchange tent and needle exchange outreach-based services. This tent would operate when the needle exchange closed in the evening, and subsequent analysis showed that factors associated with receiving needles from the Vandu needle exchange tent included frequent cocaine injecting, injecting in public, requiring help injecting, characteristics associated with HIV risk behavior and HIV infection in our setting. Fortunately, partly in response to the growing body of evidence explaining the very pathetic deficiency in needle exchange delivery in our setting, the bureaucracy started to take some action, and between 2000 and 2002, the local regional health authority decentralized and expanded the needle exchange program and also moved away from a focus on exchange towards a focus on distribution. More specifically, there was an expansion in the number of sites and methods used for distribution. Most of the primary health clinics and NGOs providing services to injecting drug users in the neighborhood were equipped to provide needle distribution, and a variety of outreach services were supported, including the drug user-initiated outreach program. And also very important, the limits on the number of syringes that could be obtained were removed. So what we've sought to do with this very simple preliminary analysis is to determine the impact of this policy change on access to syringes and syringe sharing among local IDU in Vancouver. Individuals included in this analysis are participants in the Vancouver Injection Drug User Study, also known as VIDUS. VIDUS is a prospective cohort study that began in May 1996, and over 1,500 injecting drug users have been enrolled through self-referral and street outreach. At baseline and at semi-annual visits, participants provide blood samples and complete a lengthy interviewer-administered questionnaire that assesses a range of factors, including access to syringe exchange. In addition to just graphically assessing the proportion of people who were receiving syringes from the fixed needle exchange. We also assess rates of syringe borrowing and lending between 1998 to 2005 using GE logistic regression. And included in this analysis were 1,481 participants, of which 37% were female, and the median age of enrollment was 33.4 years. And at each six-month follow-up, we restricted the analysis to active injectors. And this first slide shows you the proportion of participants reporting that they are getting their syringes exclusively from a fixed needle exchange. And these arrows show when the program changes were implemented over about a two-year period. And as you can see, there was a substantial decline in the proportion of people getting their syringes from fixed needle exchange sites. And that probably reflects the fact that now they were getting them from other locations, including the various outreach services in the neighborhood. When we look at syringe borrowing in this period and consider the period during which the program changes were implemented, again, you also see a very substantial decline in syringe borrowing. When we looked at syringe borrowing in our multivariate GEE analysis, you can see that the period after the policy change was associated with a greater than 50% reduction in syringe borrowing after adjustment for a variety of potential confounders. When we looked at syringe lending, we see yet again a very similar effect with the program changes being followed by a substantial decline in syringe lending. And again, in our multivariate GE analysis, the period after the policy change was associated with a greater than 60% reduction in syringe lending. So in conclusion, despite the obvious limitations associated with this type of analysis due to its observational and the self-reported nature of the data, we feel that these findings show that efforts to improve needle exchange services through the decentralization of services and removal of distribution limits were accompanied by declines in syringe borrowing and lending. We believe these findings have implications for best practices in HIV prevention for IDU. Specifically, these data show that needle exchange programs can be improved upon and more effectively delivered when they're decentralized, when limits on the number of syringes distributed are removed, and also when the injection drug using community is involved in the delivery of this type of program. However, our findings also indicate the need for additional complementary policies and programs to address ongoing rates of syringe sharing in this community. I'd just like to acknowledge the VITAS participants, our study team, and our funders, the U.S. National Institutes of Health and the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. And we're now going to open the floor for questions. And I'd invite you all to, if you have questions, I think there are some microphones somewhere. Yes? Okay. And I'd ask you to keep your questions short. And the presenters, I'd ask you to keep your responses short. So the first question comes from Thomas Kerr.
I have a question, I guess, for Carolyn, but I would also be interested to hear from Alex or Lisa. I'm aware that there's been quite a bit of discussion and debate about the Australian heroin drought, which we understand started in around 2001. And there's also been quite a bit of interesting discussion about the causes of that, whether it's a domestic or a global phenomenon. In the data you showed, there was quite a noticeable decline in heroin use that occurred starting in 2001 and continued to 2004. And during that same period, there was an increase in methamphetamine use. But your data ended in 2004. I'm wondering if any of our Australian colleagues here can comment on what's happening now. Has heroin use remained low? Has it made a comeback? And what's happening with methamphetamine use?
My reading of the data is that those patterns have continued, so heroin use is still lower than it had been in previous years, and methamphetamine use has continued to increase, or at least continued at the rate that I showed. I don't know whether Alex and Lisa want to add to that.
I think in the last survey that was the first year ever in 13 years that methamphetamine was the most commonly drug reported as the last injected drug, so it actually superseded heroin for the first time. And also we've seen a lot of an increase in the injection or reported injection among that group of diverted opioid preparations.
Okay, do we have any other questions from the audience or the panel? Someone here, please. And please state your name and where you're from.
Barry Blaine from Sydney, Australia. In the presentation of Dr. Montevalli and Dr. Dvorak with the prison and people in prison, in addition to measures for harm reduction with drugs, are condoms provided for prisoners, or in those prisons isn't there any male-to-male sex in your country?
Obviously you can prevent spread through IVU. Some of these people, there's men who have sex with men, would be spreading the HIV in that way.
Thank you for your comments. You know, this is first of all, we have, as I told before, about the sexual contact and sexual transmission of HIV from these IDUs to other people or among them. We have done some things, and but you know, it's a bit more difficult to justify the authorities to, to distribute condoms or to easily accessible condom distribution in the prison. But we are going to at least give condoms for to the IDUs if they have carnal visit with their spouses in the prison. And we don't know even if how large is this problem, male having sex with men within the prison, and how much important it is in the transmission of HIV within the prison.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah, Hannah from Google. I'm from Holland, but I'm supporting an Indonesian program which is also preparing harm reduction strategies in prison. I have a question for Dr. Matvalian. We are only starting, but it seems very difficult to select prisoners eligible for a methadone program in our setting, and I would like to have your comment on that. So far, for example, urine testing performs very different from outside, because maybe people don't have daily access to heroin, so it's many of the tests turn negative, even though we suspect people are really injecting. And I was just wondering if you could allude a little bit on your inclusion criteria in prison.
As I mentioned in my presentation, it was a voluntary basis, and how we defined the IDU in the prison. If it was two routes for as evidence of injecting drug use. One, the first was self-report, and the second was the physical signs of drug injection, especially for the new entrants. And we didn't perform any urine analysis to confirm the cases or to search for the cases of IDUs within the prison.
Mauro Guarinieri from Italy. A question for Dr. Dvorak. Because at one of your first slides, when you were like introducing the issue, it looks like that transmission and injecting drug use is decreasing. This is one of the main arguments for, especially in Eastern Europe, to reduce funds and reduce investment in armed action, in the belief that the epidemic is moving to the general population. Do you believe that in reality what happened is that the surveillance system has improved? And do you think that still in Eastern Europe we are facing a mostly concentrated epidemic and therefore the main response should be harm reduction? Because you mentioned some, the political environment is not very supportive. This is one of the main arguments we hear from Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for your question. It's really very interesting issue, and now it's a subject of argued between professionals. According to our estimation, it's really true that HIV moves step by step to general population, but it does not mean that it became less active among IDUs. Among IDUs, we still have about 60, 65 different regions, 50 different regions, 70% of all IDUs HIV infected. And they have sex partners, and through sex partners they spread HIV more broadly than in previous years, like 10 or 8 years ago. And anyway, the HIV concentrated among IDUs or their sex partners. And we try to convince our policymakers that issue of treatment of drug users, this is the main issue of prevention of HIV among, including general population. Because the more people involved in epidemic, the more people from general population put in this group. But anyway, still IDUs on the first.
I'd like to make a comment, please. Up here.
Yes, please.
Straight ahead. I'm from Ukraine, too, and I'd like to compliment my colleague, Sergei, on a very good presentation, and that we should acknowledge him operating under rather severe circumstances. I sit on the CCM, or the NCC, of the National HIV Coordination Board, and there's been a big seesawing between those of us that would like to see substitution therapy with methadone to become the standard therapeutic modality to arrest the epidemic of HIV among the injecting drug users. As Sergei said, the power ministries, Interior, the finance, the justice, they're against this. They have their own political agenda to solve. And while Sergei may not be able to speak as candidly as I think one should share with you the need and how to elevate this from just the level of a scientific paper into an issue of policy development and policy advocacy. The one redeeming factor in the struggle is the Global Fund. The Global Fund has said to Ukraine, thou shalt have methadone substitution therapy, or thou shalt not have money. And this effort at good governance, I think, will eventually tip the scales so that Ukraine will have methadone therapy and our dear colleague Sergei can implement it. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a question from the back.
Greg Dorn, the National Centre in HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research, Sydney. Questions are sort of general questions to the panel. It's around the potential differential impact of therapies on HIV incidence. And the data from Ukraine in terms of buprenorphine and enormous reductions in injecting risk behaviour, does that sort of lead to the possibility of a randomised evaluation of buprenorphine and methadone in terms of primary endpoints of blood-borne virus transmission? Are those studies already being done? I mean, is it feasible and ethical to do such a study?
The question is, has the marked reduction in risk behaviour among people receiving buprenorphine in Ukraine opened the possibility of having a randomised controlled trial to look at this in the Ukraine? I think that's the question.
Against methadone, Alex.
Against methadone, sorry. Against methadone.
You mean, is there some special reason against methadone?
Yes, comparing buprenorphine and methadone in a randomised controlled trial looking at risk behaviour.
No, but we did not use methadone in our study.
The data is so impressive in terms of risk reduction that in a setting of very high HIV incidence among injectors, maybe there is a differential impact of buprenorphine versus methadone in terms of reduction of incidence.
I think reduction in our study connected with the situation that it was very first pilot project, and clients were very enthusiastic to participate in this, and maybe this is why we got so dramatic changes. And in other studies, maybe we cannot observe so big differences between baseline and follow-up. But we did not work with methadone, and unfortunately, I cannot say something about methadone treatment in our country.
Can I just add to that, Greg? The sort of available data on the comparison between, well, in terms of the way methadone works in HIV reduction is that it reduces the amount of injecting and therefore reduces people being put at risk. And the comparative data between methadone and buprenorphine to date shows that methadone tends to perform a little bit better than buprenorphine on those fronts. But I'm certainly not aware of anything that's looked directly at HIV as an outcome.
I'm going to ask my colleague Lisa Maher to ask the next question.
I'd just be interested to hear more from Dr. Sapat about the very important study in Thailand and about perhaps to elaborate on what you think might have driven those declines in injecting risk behaviour in the drug users in the trial.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, there are the falling of the injection, frequency of injection significantly, and sharing of equipment has fallen significantly also.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and why do you think that happened among the drug users in your trial?
Oh yeah, we have a package of prevention for them. We have counseling, education, and distribution of bleach and condoms, and we have HIV testing with pre- and post-test counseling, and also methadone maintenance program.
Thank you.
Okay, sorry, there's a question here.
Kim Page Schaefer, UC San Francisco. My question is in follow-up to Dr. Mayer's question to Dr. Gongchimi. I wonder if you could speculate about what the impact of providing clean needles would be to your population. That obviously you've had a significant impact in, with your package, if you increase the comprehensiveness of that by providing clean needles. What would the impact be, and what do you think the some of the ethical and political issues are, if you could comment on that, please?
Oh. Needle and syringe are not provided in Thailand because it is against law in Thailand. And Bangkok Metropolitan Administration has been providing an extensive package of proven prevention measures, including methadone maintenance treatment, intensive risk reduction education and counseling, and condom and bleach distribution. And these interventions significantly reduce reported risk behaviors among participants in a recent HIV vaccine trial conducted in the same BMA drug treatment clinic. And as I have just described, they appear to be reducing risk behavior in the current trial.
Are there any other questions? No other questions? In that case, I might just make some concluding remarks. We've heard presentations from five countries, and regrettably in four of those countries have had the devastating experience of catastrophic spread of HIV among injecting drug users, and in many of those countries the infection has spread beyond the injecting drug users to other members of the community. One country, Australia, has so far been spared this terrible result. But now we're seeing that in at least four of these countries, we're seeing vigorous efforts now to try and stem the HIV epidemic. In three of those countries, it's been quite a struggle, as you heard. And I think what we were reminded of above all else from this session is the importance of, wherever possible, starting prevention efforts early, before the epidemic gets out of control, and being very vigorous about it. And I think the paper from Vancouver reminds us that it's not only important to do HIV prevention among injecting drug users, but also to do it properly. We're also reminded, I think, particularly from the last exchange, about the importance of doing the entire package. It's now really beyond scientific debate that needle syringe program adds considerable power to the HIV prevention efforts. And so we hope that in all countries that are threatened by this terrible epidemic among injecting drug users, that the whole of the package will be implemented, and that there won't be cherry picking of just things that are acceptable, and the less acceptable things will be left to one side. I'd like you to join in thanking all of the speakers. It's been an outstanding session, and it's a testament to the widespread progress that's occurring around the world. I'd like to finish on an optimistic note by quoting to you the words of President George W. Bush, who said, when it comes to Iran, all options are on the table, and as we've heard today, maybe not in the way that President Bush intended it, at least when it comes to HIV prevention among injecting drug users in Iran, all options are on the table, and we can be very grateful to the example, wonderful example, that you and your colleagues are showing in your country, in your region, and around the world about what can be done. And so thank you, all speakers and presenters. It's been an excellent session.